Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit with filmmakers and historians and we talk about wars in history. Today we have two guests, so it's a little bit different today. We have Dan Hill, the founder of Battle Guide, which is a really cool battlefield tour company, and they also have an amazing YouTube channel. And he's a military historian and co-host of the podcast Not So Quiet on the Western Front. I love the name, by the way. Also joining us is Dr. Spencer Jones, who's an award-winning historian, author, senior lecturer at the in Armed Forces and War Studies at the University of Wolverhampton. Hope I said that right. And also co-host of the podcast Not So Quiet on the Western Front. Thank you so much for joining me today, you guys.
Pleasure. No problem. Looking forward to it.
So you guys do so many things. It's like you do this, you do this, you do this. And it's funny because when you're into military history, you have these moments where you're like, why doesn't somebody just take us on a tour of a battlefield and put some arrows and make a documentary style thing and all, like, why doesn't, and you're the guys who do that. So thank you. And how long does it take to make some of those battlefield, those virtual ones that you can see on YouTube?
Well, the videos, the long and short of it is it depends on how complex the story is. So I was just talking to Spence before we came online just now that working on one today, which is really quite complex and convoluted. And so, you know, they can be quite tricky from that point of view. Other ones, story really tells themselves. You know, Spence and I both love history, as I know you do as well, Emily. And sometimes those stories don't need dressing up. They don't need embellishment because they're simply incredible as they are. So really, it's a privilege to be able to tell them. And to just tell it in a straight, historically accurate way as much as possible is always the target, I think, of any historian, in a sense. And I'd like to think it's what we try and do with the podcast as well.
Yeah, if I can just come in on that as well. I think the easiest way to sum it up is it takes as long as it needs. And some stories are complicated and we can hopefully bring a bit of clarity to what happened. Others are straightforward. I mean, some of the stories that we tell or cover, they're almost unbelievable. You wouldn't believe them if you hadn't seen the primary evidence. And they can be quite easy to tell, but you still have to tell them right. So it's definitely a labor of love, I think. Certainly the podcast, and I'm sure your videos too, Dan.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's just one of those things, you know.
Yeah, I was watching the Storming of the Rhine video, and I was just like, the amount of skill and effort that goes into this is just mind-blowing. So I was like, God, this must take forever to put together. But that was a really, really cool one. I know you have some videos that are from members and some that anybody on YouTube can just go watch right now if they're interested. And so let's hop into your podcast for a minute here. Not So Quiet on the Western Front. I wanted to talk firstly about the Battle of the Somme. You have a lot of information on that battle in multiple episodes. And you guys did a really impressive job of like it all in there. There's so much. And I was like, how are they going to do this? And you actually did it pretty well. So the Somme, 1916, France. It's the first time that allies kind of came together to be like, wow, we're losing the war. Is that right? Like, and they're like, we need kind of a plan.
Yes, absolutely. That was the year before the so-called Chantilly Conference in late 15. Oh, okay. 1915 is a horrible year of the war for the allies. You can play a sort of dreadful trivia game. Can you find a clear battlefield victory any of the Allies win in 1915? And there's one or two, but there's not many. It's an appalling year of the war for everybody, especially the European Allies. Serbia's overrun, completely defeated, army evacuated. Russia's invaded, loses hundreds of miles of territory. France has the bloodiest year of the war in 1915. Can't make any dent on the Western Front. The British and Indian Army loses over 60,000 casualties at the Battle of Loos alone in October and November 1915. And really at the tail end of 1915, the Allied leaders have to sit down because they cannot carry on the way they have. If they do that, they're going to lose the entire war. So the general offensive concept is born from this really the bleak situation. If you don't change your strategy, repeat 1915, the war's probably going to be lost. So they come up with this idea, the general offensive. All the remaining armies in Europe are going to attack more or less simultaneously. And that's the first time the Allies have coordinated like that since the war began, which is quite a bit of an indictment on how the Allies organize their strategy. But the fact that they decide to do this, I think, speaks to the dangers of 1915.
Wow. So the Battle of the Somme was kind of like a test of that in a way, would you say, or of the battle plans, I guess?
It was the British contribution to the general offensive. So general offensive, the Italians are going to attack in the Alps. The Russians are going to attack in what is now Ukraine. The French and the British are meant to attack simultaneously on the Somme, side by side. The French army, a lot more experienced, better equipped, a better army overall than the British in 1916. French will carry the weight of the offensive, the British will support. And all these offensives are going to take place in June or July 1916. And the idea is you overstretch the Germans. They have to deploy their reserves here, there, and everywhere. The problem with the Somme, though, is that the Germans have a vote as well. And the Germans actually launched their own offensive in February 16 at Verdun. And that draws off huge numbers of French forces. In fact, that will be the main battle for the French in 1916. And that means as the Battle of Verdun goes on and on and on, the British have to take more and more weight at the Battle of the Somme. And that's going to, it never becomes a purely British battle. There's a substantial French contribution, right, but it now becomes primarily a British battle.
Interesting. And would you say, like, so I think that the general idea is that the British weren't as war ready, even as France, kind of. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there's some real truth in that. I mean, the main thing, if you look back in history, 100, 200, even 500 years before, Britain's always had this ace that it can play, and it's a kind of big blue wet thing that sits in between continental Europe and mainland Britain, and that's the sea. And so really we've invested a lot of our military infrastructure into naval power, and particularly in the Age of Empire, Britain has a huge empire in 1914. All of that is linked by this kind of motorway that is the sea. And so Britain has really, really invested heavily in that. We do have a substantial but small and widely dispersed military in terms of the army as well. Really, they're used for colonial fighting. They're used for wars of empire out in the far reaches of the world. But in terms of a substantial continental land army, that's something that Britain's never had and never particularly wants either. They don't fight the same system as France or Germany. I mean, Germany in particular, you look at them, they're surrounded by very big, very powerful land-based enemies, I should say, who have a border directly with theirs. And from that point of view, they have to invest in their army. Britain doesn't really have that situation. She's got a few options, if you like, in terms of where to pick and choose those fights. And so the Navy has always been the major investment. But when the Great War comes along, as we know, all of a sudden that has to change, and it has to change quickly. And I think, Spence, that's really the problem as far as Britain see it. It's not necessarily the fact they need to grow, it's the fact they've got to grow so quickly.
Completely so. And in 1914, when the war breaks out for Britain in sort of August, there's an emergency meeting between the government and the military where effectively they sit down and go, what are we going to do? And the decision's made there by Lord Kitchener, who's the Secretary of State for War, that this is going to be a long war. It's going to be a bloody war. Britain's going to need to raise an enormous army to fight it. But Kitchener's vision for the war is Britain will start raising this army in 1914. He's under no illusions it's going to take a long time to prepare. He envisages it being raised through 1914, 15, and 16, and only really going to France in strength in 1917. Then it'll be fully trained and equipped and it can do something. But because the Allies have such a disastrous strategy, really 2 years between 1914 and 1915, in terms of casualties, that means that the British get rushed. They can't just sit by and watch France, which is losing enormous numbers of men, watch Russia, which is being invaded, watch Serbia that's being crushed, and say, well, we're not ready. We need another year. Europe's engaged in a life or death struggle, and Britain has to play its part. And so the army that's going to fight at the Somme is Kitchener's army, but it's in France a year earlier than he anticipated. And it's been brought there by the crisis of 1915, the need to do something different in 16, and now it's going to play a much bigger role because of the Battle of Verdun. So all these factors have combined to mean this inexperienced army, which is all volunteer, which is quite unique, not completely as well equipped as it should be, inexperienced at all levels, command levels, staff levels, levels of the common soldier and the junior officer, it's going to have to fight the biggest battle in British history up until this point. And many of the problems of the Somme are found in this lack of experience and the speed, as Dan says, which with the armies have to be put into action. There just isn't the time to train it or equip it properly.
Does that come into play with General Haig? He was in charge at that point, and there seems to be a lot of controversy about him. Like, oh, he was terrible. Oh, he did the best he could. What's your general take on Haig at the Somme?
I'll pitch that one to Dan to start with.
Would you keep him in charge or pick someone else if you had your pick?
Right. So, I mean, we'd need literally hours to go through this. In fact, I think we've already dedicated hours to this on the podcast, but we'll try and do the condensed version. I think numbers come back to this in a big way, actually. I mean, British Army, if you take the total number of people from different Commonwealth nations, including Britain, who served in a British Army uniform in the First World War, we're talking 8.7 million guys. 5.4 million of them are going to see service out on the Western Front. That's a number that no military commander in British history has ever had to deal with anywhere near that amount. This is exponentially larger. And so what you really need in this sense, and this is where I think you can argue that Haig has some real positives, is that you don't really need a battlefield commander at that point. What you need is a grand strategist. You need a manager. You need a CEO. And you know, the same thing could apply. Quite often, one of the things that's waved at generals in the First World War as a negative is, well, they're not in the front lines. You know, they're not going over the top with their lads. Yeah. I mean, there's a really important point to make with that. You know, they shouldn't be. That's not their job. There are other people who have that job. It's like going into Walmart and being served at the checkout counter by the CEO. Doesn't happen. He's got people that do that job, right? So that he's got other things that he needs to be doing in the same way that Douglas Haig does. He fights his war across a desk. He implements strategy, and the commanders below him are going to do the tactical work. They're going to work out how to fight on the battlefield. So it's really, he's at the top of his structure. And I think, Spence, when we talk about this a lot, there's a good reason why people do blame Haig. And that's because even at face value, you look at something like the Great War, and you say, how could so many people become casualties and have such terrible loss and this guy not be to blame? How could it be anything other than this guy's fault?
Right.
One way of looking at it. The same way that we could look at the 1st of July being the worst day in British military history, 19,000 plus guys killed under a 24-hour period, staggeringly awful numbers. He's actually not the on-the-ground commander. It's a guy called Rawlinson. But also, if we're going to give him credit for the blame for the worst days, do we also give him credit for the best ones? Because ultimately, the BEF and the Allies are going to come out of the war victorious. So it's such a tricky subject to cover. We could go on about this for hours, I'm sure, and I'm sure Spence will too. Yeah.
Just to add some weight to this, I think one of the problems with Douglas Haig is he's a man with obvious talents. He's got a tremendous mind. He's been a real theoretical thinker before the war. He's certainly highly energetic. He has a vision for how he wants the British Army to fight and how he wants the war to be fought, which really sets him apart from his predecessor, Sir John French, who hasn't had that. But he's also got some serious flaws. And one I've mentioned on the podcast is he's overly optimistic. And that doesn't sound like a flaw, but in military command, it can be, because Haig will get a piece of information that seems positive. Your German morale seems low. There's been a large number of German deserters or a large number of German prisoners taken, and they say it's terrible on their side of the line. And he multiplies it in his mind over and over and over again. And this leads him time and again through 16 and 17 to tinker with objectives and always try and go a bit further than his subordinates want him to. And he commands in a style, especially in 1916 and 17, that we might describe as using a long screwdriver, reaching over the shoulder of his commander to tinker with the machine in front of them. And it creates a lot of tension. And on top of this, we know from Haig's own writing, because we've got his diaries from the war, he's not always the, shall we say, the most caring man. And some of the things he puts in his diary are very callous. Criticizing units that have effectively been destroyed by German machine gun fire for saying, well, they didn't get out of their trenches. They're cowardly. And this is, you know, not pleasant to square, even in the 1920s and 1930s, when this news starts to leak out. I think the best summary of Haig we can give, actually, is from Winston Churchill. And Churchill knew Haig. They were never friends, but they knew each other. And Churchill described Douglas Haig as a very talented, modern surgeon. And this surgeon will use all of the tools at his disposal for his patient, and he will use them skillfully. But at the end of the day, if his patient dies, he'll clean his hands and say, well, I did all I could. And I think Judge Lew was a good judge of character. I think he captures something about Haig there. Haig's a cold fish. He's doesn't have the common touch that a lot of generals of the Second World War have, for example. And that makes him, given what happens with the army, it makes him a figure that's easy to criticize and condemn. But you ask, too, who do you replace him with? And one of the problems, actually, in 1916 is who is there in the British Army who's an obvious replacement? And there isn't really anybody. That either they've become ill or they're out of action for some reason, like General Smith Dorrien, or they've not got as much experience as Haig. And one of the interesting things is the British government, really, through 17 and 18, really wants to replace Douglas Haig and is always looking for an opportunity to do so, never finds one. There's always something gets in the way. And it's difficult, I think, to really reach a balance on Haig. And just to emphasize this, there's been two really important biographies published of Douglas Haig in the last 15 years by two leading British academics. And they both use the same sources and reach completely different conclusions. One thinks that Douglas Haig's brilliant. The other thinks he's a complete idiot and a rotter. So I think that gives you some idea that it's really difficult to square this debate.
I would love to read those books. That is fascinating. Okay, yeah, he's very controversial. I think that he doesn't deserve a lot of the criticism he gets, because especially across the board, you see in Austria, in the US even, and everywhere, you see this general thing in World War I, this general impression of, like, I wouldn't say incompetence, really, but like people that really were not prepared for this style of war. And it's kind of across the board. And I don't think it's like, it's kind of odd that people focus on Haig a lot. And it's like, why? Like, he definitely wasn't the worst, like, at all. And it wasn't particular to Britain either. So that's very interesting. I wanted to ask, too, was this kind of issue with the quality of weapons that were coming out, and where sometimes they would misfire a lot, or sometimes, you know, you even have the Austrian army greasing up their guns so they won't rust, now they won't even fire. And you have all this crazy stuff. Would you say that the quality of weapons played a part in the Battle of the Somme or in Verdun even?
Well, with my Royal Artillery hat on, one of the big striking things at the Battle of the Somme is by the Royal Artillery's own estimates, somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4 British shells don't detonate at the Somme. Then they either go blind or they're dud, don't detonate properly, they bury themselves in the ground, or they go way off target, don't hit anything. That's a huge failure rate for artillery. And a lot of that is because the war industries that are supplying them are completely new. They've been generated almost overnight. The quality of work's low. The speed of work is high, but the quality doesn't match. And in fact, there was a study done from the German side of the Battle of the Somme by a historian called Christopher Duffy. And he raised this intriguing conclusion that if the Royal Artillery shells hadn't misfired so often, the Battle of the Somme would have been won. The German defenses would not have survived this bombardment if 1 in 4 shells wasn't failing to detonate. And I think that's a huge role. And when you add on top of that, the fact that you have, especially in the artillery, weapons that are not reliable, or not completely reliable, being manned by very inexperienced gunners and crews. A lot of gunners who go out to France prior to the Somme, they've never fired their guns before until they actually reach France, so they're not experienced with them. You've got a recipe for serious problems. And I think that inexperience element, combined with this weakness in equipment, it's a real cocktail for trouble, a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I don't think that gets enough attention. And Dan, I wanted to ask you, so you said that you do this really cool thing. It seems like a dream job to me, where you actually take people out onto the battlefield, the location of Battle of the Somme. You go up on a hill and you're like, how would you do it? How would you get across no man's land? How would you survive? Can you tell us a little bit about what you do with that? Because that is fascinating.
Yeah, sure. It's in short, one of my jobs, particularly one during the summer months, is as a battlefield guide. So I'll take people out to battlefields, which range really from the Battle of Waterloo right up to the end of the Second World War. And what we'll do is go and explore battlefields. And I kind of had a little smile to myself when Spencer was describing the failure rate of artillery there, because quite often when I'm walking around the battlefields of the Somme, one of the things you find, many of them we should add, are those unfired or unexploded shells, which are still lying out there on the ground to this very day. So it's amazing, you know, nearly 110 years have passed now, and, you know, we can still go back to those same spots, and they're still teeming with signs of what once passed there. And I think for me as a historian and somebody who just loves history generally, being somewhere and being able to connect, you know, the kind of things that we talk about and we study at home with actual spots on the ground has just got such a powerful resonance. And, you know, for me, there's nothing better than going out, exploring a battlefield on the ground and just seeing, trying to understand it from that kind of soldier's eye perspective, because it really does give you a completely different view as to what you'd find if you look at it just through books or just through films or just through documentaries. It's such a tangible, you feel like you're literally standing in that kind of moment in history.
Yeah. Is it kind of like a stumper for most people where they get up there and they're like, well, I would not do that, and then I would wait, never mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are definitely elements of that. And, you know, it's interesting when you go on the ground, and I've taken people ranging from school children up to serving army generals, and you take them to the same spot and you can literally pose the same question. You can say, right, there's a tree over here. There's a building over there. There's a river running down the bottom of here. How do you get your guys from point A to point B without everybody getting killed by the machine gun that's up on that hill? And it's interesting how you look at the way that people analyze these scenarios. And quite often, despite being from totally different backgrounds, they come up with the same logical responses. And very often, they're the same logical responses that the guys came up with 100 years ago as well. So, you know, it's a lot of things have changed, but some things never will. And I think part of that is the way that the human mind works. And it's just incredibly fascinating to see.
That's awesome. God, what a dream job. Like, that is just incredible. I have one more question about the Battle of the Somme. There's this idea about World War One on the home front where World War One was kind of the end of long summers and garden parties. It was the end of a kind of world that never was the same after the war started. And the Battle of the Somme kind of has the same idea about that in World War One itself, where nothing was the same after that. Can you tell us why?
Well, it's a good question, and I think there's an element of truth in this from a British perspective, because the army that goes over the top on the 1st of July 1916, every single man's a volunteer, every single one of them. It's an army of a volunteer army of a size that Britain has never raised before and will never raise again. By the time the Battle of the Somme finishes, the army's very different. You've got conscripts now mingling in with us. By the time the war ends, about half the army's conscript, about half the army's volunteer. And there's a spirit of hope that this army has. It's got a unique sense of morale, a unique sense of mission. They're confident on the 1st of July. And there's almost this unbearably poetic vision that the 1st of July is a beautifully sunny day, just a handful of white clouds, beautiful blue skies. And this very brave, but perhaps a little naive army goes into action expecting a victory and instead suffers the single bloodiest day of the British Army history, not just in the war. And there'll never be an army like that again. In the Second World War, there's conscription. It's all conscript. And so there's something unique about this. And the casualties that army suffers become emblematic for a world that's been lost. And in the post-war world, in the 1920s and 30s, what's quite interesting is it's not seen as happening at the Somme. It's seen as happening at Passchendaele the next year. That's the battle that changes everything.
Oh, okay.
But by the 1960s, 50 years on, when it comes up to the 50th anniversary, the mood changes again. And now the mood is more, it's the Battle of the Somme that changes everything. So I think the very fact that the perception in Britain about what battle changes this mood has changed within the century tells us it's a little more complicated than that. But I think it comes to represent a yearning for a world that was lost, the pre-1914 world, a world that probably is much more fondly remembered or imagined than it was when it was lived. But we can all be nostalgic. And I think the Somme plays a big role in that in the 1960s, especially, and has continued to do to this day. But what do you think, Dan?
Well, that's great. It's a great question. I don't really disagree with anything you said there. I think actually, you know, it's exactly the, you know, as far as the story of the Battle of the Somme goes, and is it a turning point? You know, is it the end of what we sometimes refer to as the Belle Epoque, that 1914 kind of Mary Poppins-esque era that you see on the home front? I would argue that perhaps we sometimes look too much with rose-tinted glasses to what Britain and the wider world was actually like in 1914. And maybe, you know, delving into that sometimes, and I'm guilty of it myself for sure. You know, if you actually look at the reality, you know, life in 1913 and 1912 was extremely grim for a great number of people. Infant mortality in London is about 20%. You know, people are working, you know, literally 6.5 days a week in a field, your half days in church wearing your second set of clothes. You're looking at a 50, 60 year career ploughing a field. You know, it's not very exciting. And all of a sudden, this great big war comes along. And there's all of a sudden there's opportunity, there's a chance for adventure, there's a chance for social advancement, and there's a chance to earn some money and be with your mates and go abroad. And so you can understand why so many people are drawn to this idea. The reality, I think, is, as you've rightly alluded to, Emily, is actually when you get out there, you know, there's these guys that do go out and they're willing to go and fight and do their bit for king and country. There's a famous historian who passed away a number of years ago now who famously said that it wasn't necessarily going out there and fighting that was the real bravery of the soldier of the Great War. Rather, it was the enduring once they realized what it was like. And I think that's really powerful. And I think that's really, when you boil down to this idea of kind of naivety and changing of the guard in terms of what there was before and what there is now, that really sums it up for me. You know, that's it's a powerful statement and sentiment.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you guys watched Downton Abbey. I'm a big fan of that show, and I thought they did a really good job of showing that transition of the war plays a big part in that show, where there's the episodes in the world before the war and then after the war. And they did a good job of showing all the opportunity and how things changed positively for a lot of people, especially women or people in the lower middle classes after the war. So that's a really good point that you bring up. I wanted to ask before I forget, I think it was Spencer who said that there are, sorry if I butchered this, but you said there are three things that are certain in life: death, taxes, and German counteroffenses. Is that right?
That's right. I think Dan may have coined that phrase to start with, but I borrowed it throughout the podcast.
It works, right? It works, yeah.
Was that something that developed during World War One, or was that something they were doing before that, this just counteroffensive kind of impression?
It was always part of German tactics, and the ideas behind it were pretty sound militarily, that the best time, if you've lost a position, if the French or the British or the Americans, anybody else has overrun a German position, when are they at their weakest? It's at that moment when they've taken it. The attackers will be disordered. They'll have suffered casualties. They're going to need to reverse the trench. They're going to need to do some work with shovels and sandbags. They're going to need to bring up their heavy guns, their machine guns. They're going to need to prepare themselves. They might be short of supplies. They're in a state of exhaustion quite often once they've captured a position. And if you can counterattack them then, that is when you're going to score results. If you wait for them, if you wait a day and then counterattack, capturing that position is going to be 10 times as hard. And so from the very earliest days in the war, the Germans have this very strict doctrine. Once a position's lost, it must be counterattacked immediately. It's better to launch a quick counterattack that perhaps isn't as well organized as it might be if you waited 4 or 5 hours, because the enemy will be even more disorganized than you. And it's actually very effective, especially in 1915 and to an extent in 1916, because it plays on a reality that when you've captured a position, it's exhausting for the attackers. And then you get hit with this swarm of German counterattacks as well. And the Germans never stop. They do it all through the First World War, and they do it all through the Second World War as well. So I'm pretty sure it was Dan who coined the phrase, though I loved it so much I started to make it my own. But it is a fact of life on the Western Front, and it's something that all the Allied armies have to contend with.
Do you think that's a part of why they just didn't give up with the whole Russia situation? Like, dude, like, you're not going to win against Russia's army. Like, just give up. Do you think that played a part?
I think it does, because one thing that the counterattacking system means is that the Allies struggle so much to break through. So when you do capture part of the trenches, which is often very bloody, and you grab this part of the trenches and you're thinking, okay, we can use this as a launch pad to move on, exploit it. Well, guess what? An entire division of German counterattack troops who have been held in readiness are about to attack you. So some 10,000 German counterattack troops are coming into action. And what this means is that Every scrap of ground is contested. Every time the Allies advance, they're going to be struck with counterattacks, and it's going to create these swirling, confused trench battles. It's going to slow everything down to a crawl. And even if a German counterattack doesn't retake the position it's lost, it disrupts the attackers so much they have to reorganize themselves. That's going to take them a few days. And the Germans, even if they haven't captured the lost ground, they reorganize themselves. And I think on top of this, and this is something I know, Dan, me and you have talked about a lot on this, is the German army is extremely good, especially between 1914 and 1916. I would argue it's probably the best army in the world at that stage.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, they're extremely skilled at what they do. They prove it time and time again. Even later on into the war, even in the last glimmers of the war, in right up to October and November 1918, when you expect really that the German army has had it, they're giving up, you know, and there are obviously mass desertions and mass abandonments and mass surrenders. There are still that kind of hardcore backbone of people who are still fighting to the very last and proving effective against what is by then an utterly dominant Allied force. So, you know, even when their backs are against the wall, you know, you can always be impressed by at least an element of German military in the First World War.
It seems like that would be severely demoralizing too. If I were on the front lines, I'd be like, my heart wouldn't be in the taking of something all the way, because I know the Germans are just going to come take it back as soon as we get it. And that seems kind of like a brilliant tactic on the German side, because, you know, maybe soldiers are like, what is the point of this?
I think it plays on a number of things as well. And this is true of armies throughout history, but soldiers can go into a dangerous state of relaxation when they think a battle's won. Start to relax, start to open up the ration packs, start to even do a bit of looting. That sometimes happens. And then suddenly you get hit with this big, powerful German counterattack that takes you completely by surprise. And you're without a lot of the weapons you started the battle with. You don't have your covering artillery barrage. You don't have your heavy weapons up with you anymore. You've left those behind in the trench. You're scattered, you're ragged, you might have men and officers down or elsewhere. It's really difficult to resist these determined German counterattacks. But, and I think in some ways this becomes a metaphor for this constant battle to adapt in the First World War, at times the German insistence on counterattacks becomes a negative for them, because the British and also the French start to bait the counterattack. So they'll launch these small attacks, capture an area of ground, and then wait. They know the Germans will counterattack, so they put the position into a maximum state of defense very quickly. They pre-register a huge amount of artillery, and when the German counterattack comes in, the British or the French are waiting for them and just smash the counterattacking formations to pieces. And that starts to happen a lot in 1917. And the Germans themselves go, well, what are we going to do now? Our counterattack methods aren't working so well. In the end, the Germans launched their big spring offensive in 18, so they don't really have to work out a new alternative. But it shows, I think, the adaptations that go on, that eventually the Allies go, well, hold on a minute, we know this is going to happen. How can we exploit it? And so there's never a single tactic in the First World War that's going to dominate forever. The enemy is always going to think about an alternative, right, a countermeasure to it. And so those counterattacks, super effective in 1915 and to extent in 16. 17, starting to become a little bit of a liability, and the Germans have to think about how they use them. But it still doesn't stop them using them. They just use them in different methods.
I'm sure we could talk about that for a long time. Speaking of adaptations, obviously we know that trench warfare, the trenches are iconic for World War I. Everybody, when you think of World War I, the first thing you think of is trenches, gases, like that kind of thing. Nobody really understood the extent of what role the trenches were going to play when the war started. I wanted to ask about when they started adapting the trenches to be more, you know, like the zigzag pattern. When did that start?
I mean, it really starts pretty quickly, to be honest. So if you can imagine sending large numbers of guys out to an area of, in this case, northern France and southern Belgium, you turn up there, you know, a couple of 100,000 guys on either side, everybody turns up. Of course, nobody has conveniently pre-dug a load of trenches for you. So they've got to be done by hand. And when they're first dug, as many good soldiers will do, if somebody tells you to go into that field and dig a trench across it, well, if you happen to have a drainage ditch that runs in that field already, save yourselves a few hours digging, just adapt the drainage ditch. And so you might get a nice straight trench, which is useful for some things. But what really happens quickly is once the practicality of really the dangers on the Western Front start to come to the fore, it starts to become clear that in order to survive for any sustained period of time, you need to adapt. And so when we start seeing this kind of crenellation, this zigzag in trenches, it's not going to take many artillery shells to land in your dead straight trench and kill half a dozen guys either side of it for you to realize we better put a turn in that trench because blasts don't go around corners very well. It's a brutal way to learn your lesson, but it's probably quite effective at the same time. So, you know, it's not many artillery shells or heaven forbid, an enemy soldier getting into your trench, perhaps with a machine gun and being able to fire in a dead straight line down it. So all of these things develop, and they develop quickly. It's what we often refer to as the learning curve. And this is a phrase that's used throughout the Great War. It's kind of, as Spencer and you were alluding to just now, this idea of tit for tat. The enemy comes up with something, you come up with a counter to that. They come up with something new, you come up with a counter to that. And it goes on and on and on. And what we see is the bar progressively rises throughout the Great War until we get to 1918. It's an extremely scientific, complex battlefield by 1918. A far cry from what we see in 1914.
So being able to get across no man's land into an enemy trench and your hand-to-hand combat, was that common? I mean, I can imagine not, but was it more common than we'd think?
I think two things, really. One, if you're in a major battle, and obviously there's major battles in every year of the war, and you happen to be in the assaulting force, then it's going to happen. But for an individual soldier, your chances of actually seeing that level of action vary quite considerably. When the British Army is small in 1914 and 15, you're going to see very, very intense action. By the time it's reached its full size, which is early 1917, it's possible for you to be in the army and never see action. You can be in trenches in very quiet sectors and nothing is going to happen. There's an image, I think, that soldiers go over the top and launch these huge assaults all the time. And in actual fact, for most of the time, they don't. Most of their time, they'll be spent holding trenches, carrying out repair works on it, maybe training behind the lines. And I remember there was some work done on this years and years ago, back in the centenary period, about how often were you likely, as a British soldier, to go over the top. And it was found that even the most hardened, long-service soldiers were probably not going to be in an over-the-top attack more than 8 times in the entire war. Now, that wasn't a huge sample, but I think that's an interesting representation. Now, that's not to diminish it, because I'm sure anybody listening, you wouldn't want to be in an over-the-top attack at all, but it gives an impression. And the reason for that is, one, your chance of surviving that number of attacks without being wounded or killed, relatively low. But also the fact that, millions, as Dan said, there's an army of millions, plus millions of French, plus millions of Americans. Not everybody is going to be in full-scale action. Not every sector of the Western Front is ablaze all the time. And in actual fact, one of the reasons why 1918 is such a bloody year in the First World War is there's a lot more combat on a much wider front. Because the trenches break down and the armies are in contact with each other, constantly fighting through villages, woods, farm fields, there's actually perversely a lot more action. And although there are some big over-the-top attacks in this campaign, there's also lots and lots of comparatively small-scale fighting, a few thousand men here, a few thousand men there, fighting over an important village or a patch of woodland constantly. And so that's why it becomes so deadly. But in terms of going over the top, there are some veterans who go over repeatedly, but it's also possible you could spend the entire war and never actually go over the top. So the image, is it happening all the time? I think we get that from movies, especially constant action. It's not actually true.
Interesting. One question I wanted to ask about trenches, and this is something I have tried to research, and I just cannot find much about it, surprisingly. Trenches have kind of been around in some shape or another since antiquity. You've got the Romans doing these long sieges, and they've got trenches, and even in the American Civil War, we had trenches. And what are the differences between, let's say, a long Roman siege with trenches versus World War One?
In terms of the physical makeup, there are significant differences. And a lot of that comes down to the weaponry of the time. So the purpose of a trench really depends on the time period and what the overall purpose of the campaign is. So, for example, when they're first created in 1914, really the very first effort of having a trench is to secure your guys from getting killed by artillery. And in many cases, that's true of things in antiquity where you get ballistas and trebuchets firing, also in Napoleonic sieges where you've got siege cannon. There's also needs to be a way that you can approach the enemy. So trenches are used, particularly in the Napoleonic period. But, you know, they're only at that point, they're referred to more as parallels. And what their job is to do is to keep you under cover whilst you can approach an enemy's outworks. I think the difference that you get with the First World War and a trench, it's really, it's a livable environment. It's an evolving livable environment. Whereas, you know, in ancient periods, you're not going to spend significant periods of time within trenches. They're generally within much shorter distances. Of course, in the First World War, you can be hit by an artillery shell 5, 6, 7 miles away. So trenches need to be far further away from the enemy. You know, in the medieval period, your trenches might be as far as the nearest longbowman can fire a bow. So, you know, the difference is really quite significant. But the you know, the purpose of trenches, particularly in the First World War, is fascinating because they do change and they become almost in a sense offensive, which really you don't find in the early part of the war. They can be used to launch attacks. They can be used to dig under enemy tunnels. They can be used to house huge numbers of troops. So, you know, they're way more complex by the time we get to 1918. But that being said, had it not been for the Roman period, we wouldn't have got to that state in the first place.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, like, at the beginning, how people kind of thought, like, oh, we'll just, you know, with a little trench, and it wasn't really the way that it was by the end of the war. Was that kind of because trenches had been used for so long, and there wasn't this idea of, well, you need to live in it for a long time, and so it just wasn't being built that way at first?
I think, in a sense, I think the reason that we see the end of trenches, and it's maybe worth pointing out for your listeners at this point, that trenches really mark the kind of the middle part of the Great War, of the First World War, World War One. We don't see trenches really until about October and November of 1914. So the first 4 months, we get a period of significant war of movement. And really from about March of 1918, right until the end of the war, so the larger part that the Americans are involved in, really trenches fall out of favor there as well, because we see the return of war of movement. We see new tactics involved. We see new weaponry brought out into the battlefield, which can defeat this idea of trench warfare, tanks most famously. So the idea of having trenches towards the end of the war is sometimes kind of, I think, Spence overlooked to a certain extent, in that actually the kind of purpose for trenches to exist doesn't really work in the same way that it did in, say, 1916.
That's very true. And just to lend weight to what you've said, Dan, I think one of the other factors is the sheer density of armies on the Western Front. The Western Front is unique because of its scale. It's not an accurate way to describe it. You can consider it as just one gigantic trench system that goes from the English Channel down to the Swiss border over 400 miles, making it the longest continuous line of fortification that's been constructed in centuries. You have to look at something like the Great Wall of China for a comparison. And on into this live and work and fight millions of soldiers, British, French, Americans, Belgians, Germans, not to mention, of course, all the millions of civilians who are living in this area. And in a way, the Western Front can be seen as a sort of gigantic trench city. And it's the sheer density of forces there that make these trenches such a ubiquitous feature. You can't get round the flank. You've got the English Channel on one side. You've got Switzerland on the other, mountainous and neutral. Nobody can go through it. So you've got to try and batter your way through directly the trenches. But when the armies are locked together and nobody can move, the one thing you can do is you can improve your defences. And so just go back to the Battle of the Somme we started with. The Germans spend years on the Somme, burrowing and digging and constructing and turning the whole area into a fortress. And you have areas of the Western Front that are like that, that have just been dug and dug and improved and improved and improved. And as Dan said, they define really this middle stage between 1915 and really up to the start of 1918. And then they break apart. They don't disappear completely, but you go back to trenches that are a lot less formalized. There are a lot more what would be called field works rather than these entrenchments that people lived in for years. And they're being broken up by the modern technologies, more modern artillery, tanks, etc., better tactics. And so the Western Front breaks apart then. So the density, I think, is really important to grasp. It's not just a single line. It's a network of lines, thousands of trenches on either side. The amount of digging that's done, the amount of spoil that's produced from this digging is astronomical. It has to be carried away in trains, because if you pile it up behind your lines, it becomes an aiming point. That's that the extent to which it does. It takes France about 20 years to completely repair all the damage from these trenches, which gives you some idea.
And you can still see them.
Yeah.
Like in, with drones and things. The last thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was the gases. That's the other thing that's kind of iconic of World War One. So first gas used at the Battle of Ypres, or Ypres, however you pronounce it, in 15 or in France. That's the first time that it's used on the battlefield. Can you tell us a little bit about the difference between, let's say, phosgene and mustard gas?
Yeah, I mean, really, you've got, there, of course, are multiple different gases. Really, you could sort of break it down into three, I think. So the very first and most common one used in the early part of the war, the one that's actually used for the very first time in April 1915, is chlorine gas, which most of us have got experience with in some way, shape, or form. If any of your listeners there have been to the swimming pool before and they've stayed in the water a little bit too long and you find you notice your eyes start stinging, well, that's chlorine. I mean, it's been diluted to maybe one part per 100,000. So times that stinging sensation by 100,000 for a pure form of chlorine that's been put into the air in an aerosol in a gas form, you know, that's pretty horrible stuff. And it's worth pointing out, of course, the first guys to experience gas in April 1915 don't have a gas mask. It's never been used in this way before. And so there's literally no escape against it. That changes pretty quickly. I mean, chlorine is a big inhibitor, which is really the true story behind gas. It's not a big killer. And even throughout the war, whilst we consider, of course, gas to be very closely linked to the First World War, it's never really a big killer. The most deadly of the gases to be deployed is phosgene by quite a way. Phosgene will do all kinds of horrible things to your internals and is a killer. But even then, the numbers of people that it kills are relatively small. The third one, I'm sure Spence will give way more detail about this, but the third one is something of a misnomer, actually, because mustard gas is by far the most commonly used of the three sort of big gases, in inverted commas. The truth is mustard gas isn't a gas at all. It's actually it's a very fine mist. It's a bit like if you take one of those squeezy bottles that you use to, I don't know, spray some kind of liquid to clean windows or a surface of some kind. It's one of those. It's a very fine mist. And what it will do is it will settle on surfaces, and it's a blister agent. So it will irritate your skin if it touches bare skin. It will cause terrible blisters, which are going to get infected and burst and cause all kinds of horrible internal problems from that. But it's not actually, it's more of an aerosol. That is a big inhibitor as well. But the real story about what gas is designed to do, it's not designed to kill somebody. It's designed to stop people from being able to function. And a great way to do that is to force somebody to fight as a soldier with a makeshift steamed up bag on your head, which is exactly what happens when you put a gas mask on in the First World War.
It's kind of like, you ever use those, I don't know if they have those over in the UK, but over here we have those like olive oil or avocado oil spray bottles. So you can just like, so I use that all the time when I make breakfast, and I'm just imagining that being like a blistering agent. That stuff gets everywhere.
Well, I mean, that's a great example. Maybe something for your listeners. So stand in your kitchen a little bit later on, spray that and kind of spin around in a circle, and then walk in there 2 days later and touch any surface in your kitchen and see if you're left with a residue on your hands. Because if you are, and if that was a blister agent, you'd be in all kinds of trouble.
It's not like, Chernobyl or anything, but are there still traces of these gases and the mustard gas oil or whatever you want to call it still in the soil in the battlefield today?
Well, not so much in the soil. They do tend to disperse, although they are quite long lasting. You know, if you were to walk through, if an area was to have been heavily gassed in 1918, you might still get gassed walking through it weeks or even months later, depending on the weather conditions. What you find out on the Western Front today, a bit like we discussed earlier, is when you find unexploded shells. Because by 1917, mustard gas is being delivered by artillery shell. If that shell doesn't go bang at the time it's supposed to, what you quite often find is that the gases or the literal liquid within it, in this case mustard gas, will sweat through the metal. So if you see a shell that's got a kind of a glistening kind of look on it 110 years later, certainly don't want to touch it, because that sweating that's on the outside is very likely going to be contaminated with gas. And that's actually the biggest risk for, if you speak to any bomb disposal guys out on the Western Front today, their concern is not high explosive shells. They tend to have degraded and they tend to not go bang. The real concern is gas shells.
I was going to ask about that, the unexploded ordnance kind of people that go out there. That would be terrifying to have to look out for all these gases. That's crazy. And I wonder if the iron harvest in Belgium, where every year all the farmers that just till their land like farmers, they're pulling up all this artillery and, you know, unexploded ordnance, sometimes barbed wire. I wonder if they have to deal with that too.
Undoubtedly they do. For quite a few decades after the war, local farmers in France and Belgium would armor the underside of their tractors. You would get people that would come out specifically to pick up particular types of weapons. So some of them are far more dangerous than others. Stokes mortars are still very dangerous. Hand grenades can be dangerous depending on the type of base that they've got in them. And of course, gas shells are going to be dangerous for the next 1,000 years.
Well, okay. I've taken up a lot of your guys' time. Thank you so much for being here and talking to me and answering all of these questions. I wanted to ask right quick before we go, are there any tours coming up that people can look out for, people can sign up for?
Well, there is actually, and this is particularly of interest perhaps to your American listeners, because Dan and I, this June 2025, we're going to be taking a tour out to the Western Front to follow in the footsteps of the American Expeditionary Force. And this is certainly from a British perspective, it's not a tour that's done that often. There's so many British battles to explore, but the American Expeditionary Force's war, which begins really in earnest in early 18 and will carry on to the end of the war, sees some of the most intense fighting the US Army has ever seen. The bloodiest single battle the US Army ever fights, the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, takes place in the First World War. And the terrain in this part of the world, a lot of it largely untouched, so you can get a really, really strong sense of the battlefield and quite a lot of different terrain as well. And quite uniquely, I think we're going to be tracing the entire course of the American Army on the Western Front. Some tours will just look at one battle. We're going to be going really from Belleau Wood with the US Marines through San Mihail, Second Marne, to Meuse-Argonne as well. And so it's going to be a great tour, Dan. I just hope the weather cooperates with us.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, it really is it's an incredible experience. And Spencer and I both spend a lot of time out on the battlefields. And one of the things we just love to do is just share those stories. So we've already got a pretty full tour. I think there may be a couple of spaces left. But, you know, to take a group of people out and actually be on the spot talking about those things that happen in some of the most iconic locations in U.S. military history is really going to be something else.
That is really cool. And can people, let's say they can't go over to Europe, can people sign up for like a virtual tour, like a personal virtual tour?
So rather than that, what we're currently doing at the moment, so through the Battle Guide platform, which includes, of course, the Not So Quiet podcast, we're creating videos that people can find on YouTube, which cover each of the kind of major episodes. We've already got one, I think, that covers Belleau Wood. It won't be long before we look at Meuse-Argonne and the Battle of Montfaucon in particular. So in the next 3 or 4 months, you'll see US First World War battlefields appearing. I think our next one, very from cool memory, is actually going to be the story of Alvin York, the famous Medal of Honor recipient.
And just to add to that, if you can't wait for the videos, Dan and I did a mini series within our podcast series that looked specifically at the American Army, really from its raising in the First World War through all its battles. So if you're interested in the U.S. Army on the Western Front, do check out our episodes on that.
Very cool. Okay. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us, Dan Hill and Dr. Spencer Jones.
Thank you.
Have a happy new year, and I hope that we talk again in the future.
Sure we will. Thank you for having us on.
Great. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bye.